WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. The number of Virginians hospitalized with COVID-19 has leveled off in the last week, but the rate of spread of the disease is still high across the state. JMU biologists patent a device to study some of the tiniest mammals around. And we talk with author Earl Swift, this month's Books and Brews special guest, about the importance of the moon missions that you may not remember. This is the WMRA Daily for Monday, September 13th. The rate of community transmission of COVID-19 continues to climb in much of Virginia. In virtually every county, the rate of transmission is high. That's when the rate of new cases within the last 7 days exceeds 100 per 100,000 population. As of the first week of September, the statewide average had climbed to 325 new cases per 100,000. That's a jump of 30%, according to the Virginia Department of Health. And that rate is strikingly higher in some places, in particular Harrisonburg and Augusta County. Harrisonburg is seeing a rate of 622 new cases per 100,000. Augusta County has surged to 812 new cases per 100,000. That's a jump of more than 26% over the previous week. In contrast, Highland County showed no new cases. And Lexington has seen its transmission rate fall somewhat from 604 the previous week to 416 new cases per 100,000. The number of Virginians hospitalized with COVID-19 has leveled off in recent days. As of Sunday, just over 2,100 people statewide are in the hospital, either sick with the disease or awaiting test results. That's according to the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association. And the vast majority of them are not vaccinated. VDH continues to emphasize that those who have refused vaccines are 8.5 times more likely to contract COVID-19 than people who are fully vaccinated. Only 0.4% of people fully vaccinated have developed COVID-19, and only a tiny fraction of those have been hospitalized. Since last week, another 137 Virginians have died from the disease, and that brings the total of those suspected or confirmed to have died in the state to 12,036. Registrars across Virginia are purging voter rolls of inactive voters. Advocates express concern that some voters might become disenfranchised. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Every year, election officials purge inactive voters, people who have moved and have not participated in two consecutive federal elections or responded to a postcard from the local registrar. That raises alarms for people like Delegate Shelley Simons of Newport News, who ended up losing a tied election when her competitor's name was pulled out of a bowl.
We just had 3,000 people in Newport News who were taken off the rolls, and I didn't hear anything about it. So I guess I am concerned about the process in terms of making sure that everyone is notified and everybody realizes that this is happening, because we have a very important election coming up November 2nd.
Tram Nguyen at Virginia New Majority says the current system of list maintenance has its flaws, but she also says it has a number of checks and balances to make sure people are not incorrectly removed from the rolls. But she says the best check is the one voters can do of their own registration.
I would encourage everybody to make sure that your registration is up to date. The state has made it as easy as possible because there's plenty of time right now to do it before the November election.
One potential fix is same-day registration. That won't happen this year. But next year, for the first time, voters in Virginia will be able to register and vote on the same day for election 2022.
As employers grapple with new vaccination requirements, one representative from Virginia proposes a new mandate for travelers. And Michael has that story.
You want to get on a domestic flight and head anywhere in the United States? Get ready to show proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test. That's the idea behind Congressman Don Beyer's Safe Travels Act, which would also apply to Amtrak passengers. Kenneth Button at George Mason University's Schar School says he expects opposition from the airline industry.
They want people to get on planes easily and off of planes easily with a minimum disruption. But I also think you have to look at the longer-term picture. If people do get any form of transmission on the flights and it's demonstrated, then the airline industry will have real problems in the longer term.
Virginia legal expert Rich Kelsey says mandating vaccinations to get on a flight is certain to bring a challenge in the courts.
I do think he'd have a better chance if he just simply said, you want to fly, you have to show that you've been tested in the last 72 hours, because that goes to whether or not a person has COVID. And so I think there's a legitimate challenge there.
Congressman Beyer says his bill is an easy step to make travel safer, adding that United Airlines has already demonstrated that mandates can work to keep airline employees and passengers safe. Michael Pope.
Biology faculty at James Madison University have patented a new device that allows them to study the behavior of some of our tiniest local mammals. WMRA's Randy Behage reports.
And this is where the camera is connected. And so you can see, looks like a shrew has definitely been in there.
That's grad student Shannon Gillen and Professor Katrina Gobitz examining one of six animal monitoring stations they have set up in the Edith J. Carrier Arboretum in Harrisonburg. The contraption is about the size of a shoebox, with a tiny basin they filled with sunflower seeds and mealworms that morning. And they have a camera pointed at it so that when a shrew, which may only weigh as much as a peanut, steps towards the food, it sets off a weight sensor that turns on the camera.
Shrews are not really well studied in terms of what they're doing out there under the leaves in their habitat and how they catch their prey, what they do with their prey, and how they interact with other species. So that's because we've traditionally caught them inside metal boxes. And so when you catch a shrew in a metal box, you handle it, you usually pick it up, you measure it, and you weigh it.
With her invention, researchers can monitor a shrew's weight, length, and behavior, all without having to trap it. The critter just leaves when it's done eating. This is especially beneficial, Gobit said, because many species' numbers are declining.
So it's important to try to find a way to study them that's non-invasive, so that we're not restraining them and potentially stressing them or injuring them when we handle them.
For WMRA News, I'm Randy Behage.
Finally today, when you think of the Apollo moon missions, Neil Armstrong and Apollo 11 probably spring to mind. But the later moon missions, mostly forgotten, made more scientific discoveries than the previous landings. Virginia author Earl Swift writes about these later missions in his new book, and he'll talk about them tomorrow night for Books and Brews. WMRE's Chris Boros asked Earl about his memories of watching the missions as a kid.
Well, I turned 13 the day that Apollo 15 landed on the moon in July of 1971, and really have very little recollection of the first three moon landings, 11, 12, and 14. But Apollo 15 I remember, and I remember 16 and 17 as well, and I remember them for one piece of transformative equipment that they carried aboard on those missions that changed the face of Apollo. And that, of course, was this tiny folding electric go-kart that could carry more than twice its own weight and was just an amazing piece of engineering. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that those last three missions were, in fact, the culmination of the entire manned space program to that point. Everything had led up, not to the moon landing of Apollo 11, but to the last three flights, Apollos 15 through 17, where all the collected wisdom of the previous decade reached perfection, and yet those missions are completely overlooked today.
Let's talk about the vehicles that they drove. I mean, how did they work, and what were they all about?
I mean, from the earliest days of planning for travel to the moon, eventually we were going to have to figure out a way to get around other than walking. It would have very little power, 1 horsepower of power. It would be made of aluminum and titanium. It would ride on wheels of wire mesh. And this thing would be driven kind of like a plane flies, with a joystick between the driver and the astronaut riding shotgun. There was a trunk of sorts behind, and the astronauts sat side by side amidships.
Talk about the astronauts who drove these machines. How did they describe the experience?
Well, it was a handful to drive. Charlie Duke told me that, you know, often there were two or more wheels off the ground as it traveled along. It would hit a bump, and the wheels would come up, the front wheels would come up, and they'd kind of hang there for a while. You know, Jim Irwin on Apollo 15 described it as a cross between a bucking bronco and a small boat in a choppy sea. And had they not had seatbelts, they would have been ejected out of the thing in the first 5 minutes of driving. But it beat walking.
What do you think the greatest discoveries were made as they drove around the moon on those missions?
To really fully grasp that, you have to look at what was possible on foot. Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin climbed down out of their lunar module and all of their travels would fit inside a football field. The farthest either man ventured from the lunar module was 65 yards. Apollo 12, the astronauts walked in total about a mile and a half. And the same goes for Apollo 14. What the rover brought was range. The three missions using the rover traveled 56 miles in the thing.
Wow.
On their very first drive, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin, Apollo 15, they outdistanced all three previous missions combined.
I think for some people, it's hard to imagine that we did all this with, you know, 1970s technology. Just imagine what we would have today if we kept going back to the moon. It seems odd that we just stopped going.
Well, it is pretty fantastic that we were able to do what we did with the technology of the day. It is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It is.
The rover was essentially a 1969 General Motors product, and I don't know if you've had any 1969 General Motors products,
no.
But I've owned two of them. They were wonderful vehicles, but if you were then to ask, well, would you drive them in an airless environment when exposed to a constant bombardment of cosmic radiation and micrometeorites moving faster than bullets, and trust that 1969 GM product to get you back to your only way home, I'd have to give that some thought.
It kind of feels like we're in a little bit of a space race right now. And what are your thoughts on the recent space achievements?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, certainly we're, you know, you can see a space race developing with other countries. What's more interesting to me is just the front and center role that private industry has taken in on the American side. And I think it's good for us. And here we have three companies going head-to-head. I think it'll be good for science, and I'm excited by it.
Do you think with the help from one of these three companies, or maybe all of them, that we'll one day have man and woman set foot back on the moon?
Oh, yeah, sure. No question.
When? I want it now. When is this going to happen?
Well, it's pretty clear it's not going to be in 2024. but, you know, I think you'll see it.
Oh, good.
Sure. And presumably, you'll see Americans do it, but you'll see people back on the moon one way or another.
Earl Swift's new book is called Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Earl will be our speaker for tomorrow's Books and Brews. We have details at WMRA.org. Earl, thank you so much for writing this book. I didn't know much about these at least final missions. It's been great to talk to you today. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. Stay safely connected and enjoy your Monday.